evening, everyone.
Thompson. My name is Margaret Carlson, and I'm an... and I'm an alcoholic and a member of the downtown group of Springfield, Massachusetts. If there are any members of the press here, we might remind you, if you've been with us this weekend, we might remind you of our tradition dealing with anonymity. Alcoholics Anonymous is built on spiritual foundations, and we are anonymous at the level of press, radio, and TV. So will you please not publicize any of the names of the people who you have seen or heard here? You know, there are no real announcements this morning, but there's one thing that I think we should do. Last night, Neil mentioned the members of his committee, and he took no credit for himself. And I think at this time that we should ask the chairman of our convention committee, Neil Graves, to stand up and take a bow. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Could we open this meeting this morning with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer? God grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I just can't get over the fact that I am here this morning, and particularly that I am standing here. The Sunday morning meeting at these conventions has always been a very special meeting for me. And I think it's perhaps because when we arrive at the convention on Friday night, we're coming out of a world of work and, you know, pressure. And we arrive here and we're all nervous and tense and uptight. And as Willie says, we perhaps at that point can listen but not really hear. And then as the weekend goes on and we become more and more saturated with the good fellowship that we have and the good AA that we hear, I don't know, I just feel as though I open up so that finally I'm really ready to absorb and really ready to want to change me and to use the things that I've heard. And of course, a few years ago, this Sunday morning meeting where I feel a particular closeness to God wouldn't have applied to me because, you see, I didn't feel that I was good enough. I felt I was bad. And I felt that God was for other people, but that I wasn't quite good enough to have a relationship with God. And I feel quite differently about it today, because you people have helped me to come to know God. And so I want to thank you for the privilege of being here this morning and chairing this meeting. You know, we meet people in funny ways in AA. And I feel that I met our speaker about 4 years ago. And I met him because somebody down south sent me a tape of a Johnny from California. And they said they had been quite moved by his message. And they wanted me to hear the tape. And so I met Johnny. And I was moved by his message. And I think you will be too. Johnny.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very, very pleased to be here. I can't think of anything that I'd rather be doing than being an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I'm glad you're here. And I'm glad we're here, and I'm glad we've been able to share the things that we've shared this weekend. And before I... get any further into thing. I want to know for my own information and not because of anything else. But we have a little custom in our part of this country, and I think it's a fantastic custom. I'd like to know if there's anybody in here for their first 6 months of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you would, just stand up so I could see you, please. Here's one. I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to caution you also and tell you that by no wild stretch of the imagination am I an authority on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm no consultant or counselor on its disease. I am one thing and one thing only. I am the example, good, bad, or different, that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will work. That for almost 15 years of my life, it hasn't been necessary for me to put any alcohol or any tranquilizing drugs in my system of any nature. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. And I'd like to be able to stand here this morning and tell you that all of the most fantastic things that I did to bring these 15 years about. But the truth of the matter is, I haven't done anything. All I did was show up. And I can't even take credit for that. Because if I'd have known where I was coming 15 years ago, the first weekend in November on a Sunday morning, I wouldn't have come. And I just wouldn't have come. Because I was at a point in my life where nothing worked. And I was at a point in my life where I was tired of even thinking that I could take the chance on being disappointed again. And I didn't want any part of it, so I had crawled off into my shell to die. And that's not a bad deal for a guy 27 years old. Not a bad deal. But I'd like to tell you how I got to where I was 15 years ago and what's happened to me in the 15 years since. I don't know whether I was born an alcoholic or not. I do know that I was born guilty. I always felt that way. I always felt like I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. And I thought that I may have been an accident of birth or something. I had a very average family. I had a drunken mother. I had a drunken father. I had four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I like to stand here and say that's the reason I'm an alcoholic. But that's not true either. I was also the middle boy of three boys. And it seemed like my mother liked my little brother and my father liked my older brother. Nobody ever seemed to have time for me. And that's the way it felt. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's the way it felt. I always felt like I was on the outside looking on the inside. I always felt like I didn't belong anywhere. I never even felt a part of that family. And I hated them for it. And I felt guilty about being there, and I didn't understand that either. I just felt weird all the time. I just run around feeling like I wasn't like everybody else. I knew that. But way down on top of all those weird feelings that were going on inside of me, I had some kind of an inherited knowledge that there was more to life than what I thought. I just knew. So I spent my entire lifetime running around trying to find this thing that I knew existed, but didn't know where it was. And I used to look in funny places for it. And I used to go to my grandmother at church when I was a little fella, and Sunday morning we'd sit out in this church, and the guy who was the epitome of authority would stand in them long flowing robes, and he'd say things like, you're supposed to love and honor and respect your parents. He'd say you're supposed to love your brothers. And I didn't do that. I hated it. And I didn't understand it. And I become frightened to death inside that people are going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. And God, I felt guilty about that. And then I'd run around and my grandmother introduced me to her God. She said, God punishes little boys who are bad. And I couldn't understand why God was punishing me. I hadn't done anything. So somewhere along the line, way back there somewhere, I got the idea that God didn't like me too much. And if he didn't like me, I wasn't going to like him. And there I sit. I hated everything that I saw. Hated my parents and my brothers and all these other things. I felt guilty about being there. I didn't belong to nothing. I didn't know what was going on half the time, and I was thoroughly confused, and everybody was drinking things that I hated, and I hated alcohol. And one day, out of my curiosity, I snuck into my old man's bootleg gooch and took a drink of alcohol. And it was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. Well, I went down there inside of me and blew all those things out from inside of me that I didn't understand. And the best way I could possibly ever describe my first drink of alcohol to anybody was that it just put me together. It just made it all right. It took all them things that I didn't understand and just put them together. And it was fantastic. But I didn't drink like most people drank from the first time, because I triggered a pattern for drinking that I followed for 20 years of my life, and it never varied. It was always the same thing. I took a drink of alcohol and went to jail. Now, if you're new here, you know, and you didn't stand up, and you're like me when you came to your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're waiting for me to tell you some way to sober up. I don't know. I always got sobered up. And I didn't have a choice in the matter, you know, because I was one of those type of people who just took off and went. And I went as long as I could win. And then they didn't want me to win anymore, so they stopped me. But I was a little kid, and I remember my first drunk. They pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. They took me out of that reform school and put me in a foster home. And I'm settled down in that foster home, and there was a knock on the door one day, and my mother showed up with a piece of paper and said that she'd been given permission by the judge in the state of Kansas to take me to California. So my mother loaded me and my two brothers in an old car, and we took off and went to California. And on top of all those other things that I was a dreamer and an illusionist. I always thought, now when we get there, things are going to be different. And my mother said, when we get there, things are going to be different. We left our one-room shack in Kansas, went to California, got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me two new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out on the street corner and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, and I filed it back here for future reference, it's the only thing that I'd ever found in my life that ever did the same thing twice in succession. I was at a point, even then, I was at the point in my life where I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was getting tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations built that high off the ground and have somebody kick the stool out from underneath me. But I had a fantastic solution to this business of living. I found out that if I threw a brick through a window, got me a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, that everything became okay. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. And I was there a little while. My mother came to visit me. She said a strange thing. She said, I love you and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different. And I thought about that. And I went back and I sit down for 2 weeks, and 2 weeks later we went in front of the judge and he sent me to the Whittier State Reform School. And my mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed it. And I thought about that. And I went back and I sit down for 2 weeks, and my mother come to visit me again. She said, I love you and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different. Now, I don't know how you are, but if I'm an authority on anything in life, I'm an authority on obsession. I've lived with them all my life, and I live with them a great deal of the time today. And I don't know how you are about obsessions, but obsessions are just funny little things that start off with me. They're just like a streaker. They just kind of, they go through there. Little thought just zips through there right away. As it goes by, I say, my God, that looked good going through there. And then pretty soon, here it comes back again, a little bit slower. And the slower it comes, the better it looks. And the better it looks, the slower it gets. And first thing, there it is. And I'm completely obsessed with the obsession I'm looking at. And it's the funny thing about obsession, it burns out all truth. You can't see anything but the obsession. And I guess one of the things that since psychiatrists and doctors and penologists and all them other kind of folks clean up the wall is that there isn't any way medically, physically, or psychiatrically to treat an obsession. I found out since I've been hanging around you that God removes them. And that's a fantastic thing to know. I didn't know that then. I became obsessed with the idea that I was going to go home someday and things were going to be different. There was going to be a white picket fence around my house. And we weren't going to live down there in that ghetto. We were going to live in a nice place. My mother was going to be nice. She wasn't going to be drunk. Everything was going to be fine then. And I went into court once a month, and there she stood and proved it. She became my champion. 3.5 years we went through this deal, me obsessed with this idea of my mother fighting my battles for me and me getting all this thing going on. And at the end of 3.5 years, I was put in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley, and I was told when I got there, if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip in 30 days. And I was good. Saturday came, they loaded us on an old truck and brought us out of the San Fernando Valley. And it was an all-day trip downtown Hollywood to catch the old subway car to ride downtown Los Angeles, to catch the old red car right out to Willowbrook where I live. And I got off the ground, off the streetcar running at Willowbrook, a mile from my mother's house. And the excitement and the anticipation, my stomach was all in knots and my head was pounding. And I was just, man, it was going to be there. I finally found that deal and I rounded the corner and into the back door and there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed. Except me. I'd spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. And anytime anybody knows you got a weakness, they use you. Never show anybody that you care for them, they used to tell me, because that's a sign of weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter, because the minute you do that, somebody comes along and kicks you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that. But something way down deep inside of me told me, no, 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 that's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself, if I lived to be 500, I'd never show anybody any human emotions again as long as I lived. And I went out on the street corner and I got drunk. And I come home next month and got drunk again. And about that particular period of my life, I was a periodic. I was a periodic because I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out one weekend a month. And there was a little market down on the corner by my mother's house, and every Saturday, one Saturday a month, he had a broken window and a gallon of wine missing. And I don't know why that guy never got wise to that, but I don't know how you are about being a periodic, but I can remember being a periodic, and a periodic is kind of a frightening thing if you're a guy like me. Because I come home this one weekend, get drunk. Just get wiped out. I drink that Marco Petri red wine and sing out there in the cornfields and things. And then I'd go back to school, and my first week back in school would be all right because I was an athlete. I'd take strenuous exercises. And my second week was all right because I was a scholar. I'd read inspirational books. But my third week was when the madness set in. Because I started to think about showing up down on the street corner. And I'd say to myself, I wonder what the guys are going to think down there on that street corner when they find out I'd rather be playing baseball than hitting somebody in the head. Wonder what they're going to think down here on the street corner when they find out I'd much rather be an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer as a gangster. Wonder what they're going to find is I don't want to be the leader of their gang and they think I should be the leader of the gang. And it felt like I had a zipper on my inside and I was afraid people were going to zip it open and find out what went on in there, because nothing went on in there that went on out here. It was always different and I was frightened people were always going to see this thing. And in the back of my mind that I'd file for future references, I thought, my God, how nice it is when you crack the seal on that Marco Petri red wine and take a big drink of it. And one day I come running down the street, threw a brick through a window, got me a gallon, and went off in the field to sit down to drink my wine. And a frightening thing happened. Nothing happened. And I drank it, and I drank it till I'm as sober as I am right now, and I was scared to death. I didn't know what to do about it because my magic wasn't magic anymore. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't you try these?" And he gave me some pills. And I found out if you ate pills and drank wine, you could make the madness go away for a little while. And it wasn't very much longer after that I was sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine. I'm eating pills and drinking wine and nothing's working. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't you try this?" And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things to sustain me for the next 14 years of my life. But never one, or it was never two, was a combination of everything. I finally became too old to stay in that school, so they threw me out of there, and I came back to my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. I'd already resigned myself to the fact that I'd never be anything decent. Well, what kind of a break did I have? I came out of that ghetto from them drunken people. Every time I turned around, they was arresting me. I had no chance, but I knew I could become a gangster. But I had a problem. I developed a problem about that time. I had difficulty standing up. And that's not very conducive for being a gangster. You know, you just don't show up down there where the gangsters gather up on Saturday. And the guys say, "Well, how'd you do last night, John?" I said, "Well, I went in to rob that guy, but I got sick and threw up on him." That doesn't make for very good conversation over the gangster table. And, I just was not successful at anything. I guess the best way I could possibly ever describe you to me was to tell you I was a never was. And if you don't know what a never was, a never was is something so frightened to fate that he doesn't try to do anything. He just sits back and says to himself, "Tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to get up off this floor or out of this room or out of this bed, out of this hospital or out of this jail or out of this place, and I'm going to step out of that world and I'm going to be the great athlete my coach has told me I'm going to be. Tomorrow I'm going to step out in that world and I'm going to be the great scholar all my teachers told me I'm going to be. I'm going to live up to that fantastic potential everybody always told me I had. Tomorrow. And tomorrow I'm going to step out in that world and be the one thing in the family that somebody's proud of. Tomorrow." But then I'd take a drink. And I'd go to sleep and I'd wake up the next morning and I'd be sick. And I'd have to trigger the whole cycle all over again. And the only thing that ever broke that cycle up in my life is when I got arrested. And I got arrested. And lied to them and told them I was older than I was, so they put me in the county jail with a gangster. God, I wanted to be a gangster very bad. Yeah. But I was a failure even at that. I went through another running court battle with my mother, and the same judge. And I guess he was getting old and he wanted to retire before that case was settled. And he didn't want too much to do with my mother. And they decided I should go in the United States Army. Now, I didn't want to go in the Army. I wanted to go to jail where the gangsters were. But Mom and the judge thought I ought to go in the Army. My mother didn't want me to put a mark on the family's good name or something. Mothers are like that. Particularly drinking mothers. Anyhow, they took me out of Los Angeles County Jail in handcuffs. And they gave me to the provost marshal in Fort MacArthur and said, "He enlisted." And I was in the Army a little while. They told me something I didn't like, so I quit. And they come to get me. And they took me back, and I quit them again. Just seeing that with my sensitive nature, I didn't like those people telling me I couldn't do things. But anyhow, they got tired of quitting me, so they quit me. And I came out and resumed my gangster career. And I guess for the next 3 or 4 years of my life, if there's anything as being successful in life before I came to you people, I was successful as I ever got. Because prior to that period of my life, I always figured if I had enough money and enough power and enough prestige, nobody could touch me. And during that period of time in there, sometime along that period of time, I got enough money, and I got enough power, and I got enough prestige that nobody could touch me. The only problem was that I couldn't come out of my apartment to see what was going on. I was so frightened I couldn't go out there. And the only time I ever felt safe, now this is a long time ago. This is a long time ago. I'm 19 years old. And I'm riding down the street at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's the only time in my life I feel safe. When all the people are out there because the police are jumping through my window and choking me and grabbing me and kicking me and trying to find out what I got with me this time. It wasn't a status symbol in those days. They used to arrest you for it. But anyhow, I say to myself as I look at the people going home from work, I say to myself, I wonder what it is about me that I can't be like other people. I wonder what it is. My God, I knew I was different. And I knew that there was a dirty deal that somebody had gave me, that I was different than everybody else. I said, why can't I be like my older brother? My older brother had never been in jail unless he come to visit me. And my older brother, if you kind of wonder what a normal drinker is, my brother is a normal drinker. Same parents, same ghetto, same everything. My brother's not an alcoholic. You know why? My brother drank 2 drinks and quit. And you know what his excuse for quitting is? He says, I'm starting to feel it. Hey. I figure that's when you stick it in the second. You know, and way back over in the first part of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it says, a little non-alcoholic doctor wrote it. It's in there in the doctor's opinion, and there's one paragraph in there to tell you the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous, people like me. It says men and women drink essentially for the effects produced by alcohol. That's why I drank. Don't know why you drank, but I didn't like the taste of it. I like what it did, though. But anyhow, if I was capable of caring about anything before I came to you people, I cared about a baby brother of mine. And I guess my baby brother thought it was kind of glamorous to be running around wearing them $200 suits with a pocket full of money, driving big cars and playing big games. I guess. He must have thought about me like a million kids must have thought about Mickey Mouse. Matter of fact, I'm sure he did. And I'm also sure, as I'm standing here, that he had this illness of mine called alcoholism. I'm just as aware of that as I've ever been before in my life. In 1951, I was residing in the Los Angeles County Jail, and my mother came to visit me. And she screamed at me through the visiting screen that I was a murderer. It seemed that my baby brother had gotten into some of my poison, taken an overdose of it, and died. And I went back to my bunk and got up there and knew I was supposed to be doing something, but I wasn't quite sure what. 3 days later, I stood at that kid's grave while they were burying him in handcuffs. I stood off underneath the tree between 2 big old detectives while they buried that baby brother of mine. And I had all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging on my shoulders. And I wanted to cry, and I didn't know how. I didn't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. And the reason I didn't have them because I didn't think they were necessary. I remember the look my family had that day as they filed by me. They wouldn't even let me go near the coffin. My family walked by me and they gave me that look. Now look what you've done. You've killed our baby. I spent the next 4.5 years of my life in a maximum security penitentiary. I came out of there and spent the next 2.5 or 3 years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist told me in San Quentin wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me the little green room one day. He says, you're even going to end up here. And I gave him my stock answer and trade. Not me, I'm different. I come off now that institution bound and determined I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I was laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming. And they come to get me. Loaded me in a car, and I made them stop the car on the freeway so I could start running again. Nothing was working anymore. As long as I was awake, I was dying. And I didn't know it then, but I know it today. As a matter of fact, I know that I was trying to get away from me and kill me because I didn't know how. But I was like doing it like most doctors were trying to do it. I was just trying to die from oversaturation. During that period of my life, I did something I'm not very proud of. But just recently, I had some measure of turning the table around, and I'd like to share it with you this morning. During that period of my nut houses, and I went to a lot of them, I was strapped down on a bed at Manager's Clinic in Topeka, Kansas. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow. And a little guy walked in that I hadn't seen for a long, long time, and he was my father. And he bent over my bed to say something to me, and I spit in his face. I told him, get away from me. And I thought for a long time I did that because I hated him so much. But the reason I did that is because I was so ashamed of what I was. That I didn't want this man who had sired this thing sitting back at him to think that was his son. And I lived with that kind of degradation for a lifetime. That kind of shame and humiliation, knowing that I was a thing, not a human being, a thing. Because things did what I did. And I was kicking me and beating me and looking and going crazy because I'd already give up any idea that I was ever going to do anything. 16 and a half years ago, this madness of mine ended up in the Los Angeles County Jail. I was strapped down on a bed with a doctor standing over me telling me I was going to die. He said, son, you're not going to live till morning. And I told him, okay. And he left, and minute by minute, heartbeat by heartbeat, hour by hour, the day went and the night came. And it went, and the next morning he walked back in my room and said the same thing to me. I told him, okay. And heartbeat by heartbeat, minute by minute, hour by hour, day into night, night into day, he come back in my room the third time, and he said the same thing. And the third time he said it, I had a terror grip me that I have never known before since. And the idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. And I was going to get up out of that bed, and I was going to go to the penitentiary and come back and start that rat race all over again. God knows I didn't want to do that. And right behind that came the other terror. That I was going to die and not do the thing I was put here to do. I knew that. I knew that laying in that bed, that whatever it was, I hadn't done it. And I knew that. So I laid there for 18 days and 18 nights. And I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I didn't know anything better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. And I went to sleep for a little while. And I kind of like to think about it that when I woke up from that sleep, I left the other thing there. Now, there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running in there and saying they got an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting down the hallway. Nobody showed up and said, Jesus, they got the wrong guy. We're letting you go tomorrow. None of those kind of things happened to me. I just got a little better. Of course, you know, when you're looking at it from where I was looking at it, that wasn't any big thing. But as I look back at it 16 and a half years later, it was a tremendous thing. A fantastic set of circumstances. I got better and better. For 16 and a half years of my life, I've been running around facing a series of truths that I didn't even know existed. And 16 years ago, last month, I was laying in a place called San Quentin, and I got a telegram from a woman that I'd married. And she told me she'd given birth to a baby daughter. And prior to that, I'd done everything in God's world to prove I wasn't a drunk. Because my old man was a drunk. And I'd always figured that somewhere along the line, I'd stayed a notch or two above my old man. But I opened up that telegram, and I said to myself, you know, no matter what kind of a bum your old man may have been, at least when you were born, he wasn't in the penitentiary for the second time. So just maybe you'd something a notch or two below your old man. But that soon ended the next day because I went down into Never Never Land where I had to maintain my image of a gangster. And I spent the next 9 months of my life in and out of solitary confinement because I couldn't stay sober at a maximum security penitentiary. And finally, they got tired of me there, so they transferred me down to a place in the Tehachapi Mountains in the southern part of the state. It's called Tehachapi. And on a Sunday morning, almost 15 years ago, I was sitting in this place, and I was sitting out in the yard and around a bunch of people, and I saw some women walk across the yard. Now, I don't care why you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I care less. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 15 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been here ever since. I came in, did a little sniffing this morning. You never know what's going to get us. Just don't know. I don't think any of us came here because we wanted to. I don't know how many of you ever sitting up on your balcony one day and say, Jesus, I got it so good, I think I'll go see what them drunks are doing tomorrow. I wandered into this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And like I told you, if I'd known where I was coming, I wouldn't come. I sit down in the back row and I looked up on the backboard. I saw two big A's up there and I said to myself, my God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. And I nudged this clown next to me and I said, what is this? And he said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be in there with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous, I'd have been there waving at. But it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, they got me trapped, so I sit around and wait for these women to tell their racy stories. And they got up and they threw me a curve. Because they had sort of a twinkle in their eye and sort of a smile on their face, and they sort of radiated a certain something that I didn't understand. A little old man that I know that I love very much called Spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what it was for a long, long time, so I just bought that. But there was something different about these people. I'd never seen them before. And they ruined it right away because they stood up and started talking to me about God. And I got up and ran out of the room. And when I came here and you talked to me about God, I left. It wasn't that I didn't believe in God. I believed in him all right. I believed he hated me. If he hated me, I hated him back. See, my God was my grandmother's God. Punished little boys who were bad. And look what he's done to me. So when you talked to me about God, I left. And I kept coming back because I'd seen you. And I kept coming back to see you. And I'm still coming back to see you. For no other reason. Just to see you. To see the power of the example of the working program of Alcoholics Anonymous proved in people's lives. I think it's been very well illustrated here this weekend where the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's written inside of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where the program is. The meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are examples, good, bad, or indifferent, that this program works in your life if you work it. It isn't anything else. And I've come to believe that there's only one reason in God's world for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's to carry the message to the alcoholic who's still suffering. There isn't any other reason for it. And if we're doing anything besides carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers, we're not having an AA meeting. And that's the way I feel about it. And I think Steve said it Friday night when he said that you never know who's suffering. What about the guy sitting next to you? Or the gal down the road? I think we may be so busy trying to get new people, we're losing all the people we got here. We got a very rash thing going on in my part of the country. Somewhere between 10 and 20 years of sobriety, we're losing people by the grove. They're just coming up drunk on us all of a sudden. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because somewhere along the line they found out that they could transfer tranquilizers into alcoholism. Maybe that's it. I talked to a number of old fellas, and they seem to be taking a couple of pills now to relieve anxiety. I told them that's the reason I drank, was to relieve anxiety. I really don't know because I'm no authority on that, but I just thought I'd throw that out there. I kept going back to those meetings on Sunday morning. And finally, a guy stood up at the podium one Sunday morning and told me the thing that I'd been looking all my life to hear. He stood up there one Sunday morning and told me I didn't have to live the way I was living anymore if I didn't want to. And he was proof of it because he'd spent 23 years in penitentiaries himself. And I knew him. I said to him after the meeting, gee, Les, how do you learn how to live? He told me there was a book called Alcoholics Anonymous over in the library, and if I'd go home and get that book, he'd go home and pray that may God find some part of me in that book. And I guess he prayed real hard because that's all I've ever found there. Me. I spent the next year and a half of my life in that institution trying to the best of my ability to fulfill the conditions of the program called Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I did that because I was going to prove to you it wouldn't work. For a guy like me, because I was different. I didn't belong here. And I was frightened to death that I didn't belong here. I was scared. I used to sit around in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I listened to what you tell me to do. You tell me you get active in the program. You go to meetings and you do things. And I got active in that meeting. I got active. I'd go greet the guests at the gate. And I was standing there and I was so bitter and so full of hostility they wouldn't even come in. And they told me, maybe you better pour coffee. And then one guy said to me, well, why don't you learn how to smile? And I told him, what's that? And he said, that's a frown turned upside down. You know, you learn some of the most interesting things here, don't you? They teach all them beautiful things. So I started to smile. I run around, pour their silly coffee and smile at them. I don't know how you ever tested anybody, but I used to test them. They'd come in and they'd stand there and they'd talk to me about things that are in that book. And I'd go back and I'd spend a whole month studying the book. And that statement better be in that book when they come back. By this time, I had a book. And I had it under my arm. And if the person who made that statement come back next month and that statement wasn't in that book, I met him at the gate. And I said to him, you're a liar. And he'd say to me, what do you mean? Or she would say to me, what do you mean? Didn't me? I wasn't discriminating against men or people. I just hating them all. And I said, you said this was in that book, and I looked and it ain't in there. They'd smile at me and say, so what? Walk off the beach. Now, you and I know that when we want to fight, we want to fight. How are you going to fight anybody? Don't fight back. They just smile at you with them smiles. Al-Anon didn't invent them smiles. Them drunks invented them when they found clowns like me hiding out in them institutions. You got to smile at a guy like me because I was so pitiful. I was trying so hard to be bad that they had to laugh at me. I was a clown. But finally, when I lost everything, when they told me my wife was going to divorce me and they weren't going to let me go home, and the parole board told me that I wasn't going to go, I just gave up everything. And I sat down in a meeting on a Sunday morning in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I held an old lady's hand, and she gave me Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I held her hand, and for 2 hours of my life, I didn't hurt. I just didn't hurt. And when she got ready to leave that day, I said to her, I asked her what it was. And she told me that the answer to any question I may ever have lied between the covers of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went into the book Alcoholics Anonymous to find this thing that she had. And I've been finding it and discovering it and rediscovering it and uncovering it ever since. And I'm most grateful for that. The two most singularly important things that ever happened to me in my life in my first contact with Alcoholics Anonymous were the two people who meant the most to me told me about a book. And it was called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you see, I'm grateful for that. Because when I came here, I didn't have the ability to believe people. I was scared that I was going to get kicked in the gut again, and I couldn't do that. But I could believe what was written in that book, so I started to do the things it says to do in that book. And things started to happen to me. I started to feel good inside. And the first thing you know, I'd found myself sitting down at a desk with a man, spending 3.5 hours telling about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And I walked out and I sat down underneath a tree, and for the first time in my life, I saw a tree. And I've been free from that day to this day. Been walking around just as free as a bell. Now, I'd like to tell you every day has been lollipops and sunshine. Every feast has been a banquet, but that's not true. Because I was embellished in the business of living. And you see, sobriety was the thing that used to frighten me before I came to you. That's the thing that used to scare me. Because I didn't know how I was supposed to live in that world out there that I didn't belong to. They didn't want any part of me, that I was different than. And the only thing that made it even bearable part way of the time when I put those things inside of me. But when you gave me a way to live, and you told me that if I would practice these principles in my life, I could live out there, I became instantly interested in what you had to say, and I've been trying to do that ever since. I came out of that penitentiary 13 years ago last June, June 4th. I went home, my mother fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. And she said, fine, I think you should. I'd like to stand here right tonight and tell you that in August, my mother, I snuck into a little meeting over in Southgate. And I watched my mother stand up and take her 1 year cake. For the first time in our entire life, my mother and I have something in common to talk about. Now, I'd like to stand here and tell you that it had something to do with that, too. But it didn't. I learned a great deal from my mother. I learned something when I was first sober in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't understand. But God, how I understand the wisdom of the speakers and people who've been before me, the old people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to get my mother sober when I first came here. Why not? I had this beautiful way of life, and everybody should have it. All newcomers go through that stage. We're going to sober up the world. And I was going to get my mother sober. And I went up to this lovely old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder, who's dead now. And I said to her, Mom, how am I going to get my mother sober? And she smiled at me. She said, you're not. And I said, I don't understand. Look at this, what I'm doing. And she said, sweetheart, remember this. You never want to deny anybody the privilege of suffering. I thought that was the most sadistic thing I ever heard. Think about it. Why are we here? I don't know why you're here, but I'm here because I couldn't stand the pain that I was living in any longer. I had suffered all I could suffer. And out of suffering comes dignity. If you don't believe it, look at the women drunks who've been here. God, there isn't anything more dignified than a sober woman alcoholic. Look at them, how they stand in dignity. And if Alcoholics Anonymous never gave me anything at all, if I got nothing else out of the whole ball game by applying these principles to my life, it's this, that I can live one day at a time out there in dignity, that I can walk around with anybody, anytime, any place upon the face of this earth and feel just as good as anybody who lives. That somehow through a working solution called Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm no longer worthless and useless and guilty and full of fear and frustration and doubt and loneliness. That's all. And that's when I got here. My wife came back 10 days after I was there. And she went and got her little daughter, that little girl. She'd be 16 years old last month. And 12 years ago last April, she gave birth to another daughter. And everything went fine, 5 years. 5 years. Just had 5 years of fantastic things, you know. I even went to work. I didn't understand it. They wouldn't pay me for standing around looking keen out there. And there's not much call for old worn-out domino players, I'll tell you. And there isn't any employment agencies out there that's advertising for unhip hipsters. So I went to work in the oil field. And I almost got beat to death out there with them pipe wrenches getting knocked off them things. But I would sing and dance and have fun out there because I remember one day I went out to... I got called out on this job one morning. And we had to break out about 7,000 foot of tubing out of an oil well. And we had no power tongs. All we had was pipe wrenches. And I had no gloves because I couldn't afford them. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and I stood at a podium, looked down, and saw my hands cracked and bleeding, and I started to cry. Because of the power of God, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been given something useful to do in this life. And I was so grateful for those calluses because I'd never seen them there before. And then I finally went around and got a paycheck. God, I was proud of that. My first paycheck. I never had one before. I've been watching folks see what they did. And they get their wife and their kids and they go down to the grocery store and buy them groceries. You know how the women load up them baskets. And you keep a mental calculation of how much they're spending. But I was so proud because I was doing what I saw all them daddies do on television. And I gave her my paycheck and she cashed it and I went home. And a little while later I went to get some money to get a haircut. She went to get her purse and somebody stole it. Now, if you want to hear somebody scream, you ought to hear a thief when they get stolen. If I could have got the guy, I wouldn't be sat here the smartest. I was insane would be a nice word to say about it. I jumped up and ranted and raved and run up and down the streets, you know. A real picture of serenity and peace. Tranquility and happiness and joyousness to the world. And I came back and I sat down and she poured me a cup of coffee and she says, "You all through?" And I says, "Yes." She says, "Now you know how it feels." Funny thing happened. About an hour later, they called me to go out on another tower. And I haven't missed a paycheck from that day to this day. Now, I'm not working in the oil fields anymore, but I have never missed a paycheck. Never had any more stolen either. I deposited them right away. But everything went along fine and dandy until I was about 6 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 5 years sober, and on my way home from my fifth birthday out of the penitentiary, my wife looked across the car to me and she says, "Don't you think it's about time you quit going to those meetings? Isn't it about time you started to contribute something to this family? Don't you think you owe me and these children something?" And I didn't know what to do about something like that. I didn't understand what was going on about me. And so I lived with that madness for about 9-10 months. I didn't understand what was going on. Finally, I couldn't hack it any longer. I just couldn't stand it because I felt guilty about going to AA meetings and I felt guilty about staying home. And I didn't know what to do about it. But one night I said, "God, I got to have a little help with this thing. I don't know what to do." And on a Sunday morning, 7 years ago last April, I got up and went to work and an hour later they pulled me off my job and told me she'd taken her own life. Okay. And I went home and I sit down in my car at the hospital and I said to myself, "Why, God? Why do you do these things to me? Why do you give me a little bit of these things and kick my brains out?" And I became very bitter and I became very hateful and very resentful and I couldn't pray. I couldn't do anything at all except go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't do another living thing. I had no power of my own. I had no ability to get down on my hands and knees because every time I thought about God, I wanted to throw up. Because there he was again, kicking my brains out, and I hadn't done anything. I had tried to the best of my ability to put this thing into life, and God knows, look what I was doing. I was doing everything I was told to do and everything I was asked to do, and things were going fantastic, and I had everything. And I turned around, and I'm 6 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've taken my house, my car, my furniture, my children, and my wife, and I'm in a $60 a month rented room in East Long Beach, just me and the cockroaches. And I said, surprise. God, did I understand it. And I kept going to those meetings because I knew nothing better to do. I didn't understand. I just had been ingrained in me so deeply that this is where it is. This is where it is. And I had enough knowledge to know that if I kept coming and sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, something would happen. And our book talks about the time in the alcoholic's life when it is absolutely defenseless against the first drink. That the power has to come from a power greater than self. And then I would say to myself, I wondered when I was out there making all those talks, how much I believed in God. If I really believed in God. I used to say to myself, wonder what would happen if I really had to call on that power. And I found out. One Sunday night, I stumbled into a meeting down in East Long Beach. And the man who was my sponsor was talking. And the only reason I went to that meeting, because he was there. And I sat in that meeting, and he talked to me about his wife and his children and his job and his home and all the things that had just been wiped away from me. And I kept trying to leave, but I was glued to the seat. I couldn't go. And after the meeting was over, there was a crowd around the guy, and I went up to shake his hand just because I was going to shake his hand, because I was supposed to do that. And I couldn't get through the crowd, so I started to turn and walk away, and he saw me, and he broke through the crowd, and he put his arms around me, and he hugged me. And he doesn't hug very easy, but he hugged me. And he said this to me. He said, gee, Johnny, he says, I admire you quite a bit. And I looked at him and I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. I don't feel like being admired. He said, God must love you a whole lot. And I said, I still don't understand what you're talking about, Norm. How could God love me? He says, he never gives any of us any more than we can pack, and those who pack the biggest load surely must be the blessed. And I didn't understand that either. And then he nailed me with these words. He says, you got to remember this, my friend. He gives the big crosses to the big hosses, and he gives the little crosses to the little hosses. And I went home that night and tried to figure out how big my cross was, and it was very small. And every time I get to thinking I got too much to pack out there one day at a time, I think about what that man told me standing in that meeting that Sunday night in East Long Beach. And my cross becomes very small. And from that day to this day, it's been in a different direction. Because I went home that night and I rediscovered my God. And he hadn't gone anywhere. He was still the same place he always was. It just, I had lost all communication with God. I don't believe that I ever took back my life. I believe that I just cut off the channel. And God keeps it open through a series of things called Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 years ago last June, I married a gal from Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life from that day to this day has been a thing of fantasy land. The most fantastic thing I know about is being able to share this program with somebody in love 24 hours a day. And that's what goes on in our house. Dottie and I got married. She was a career girl, 34 years old, never been married before. 4.5 years sober. And here I am. I don't know what it was, but I've been sober a little while, and I got 2 little girls. And we didn't know how to raise children, so we just thought we'd treat them like drunks. They're doing pretty good. Pretty good. My oldest one graduated from high school this year. She's a junior. She's graduating in her junior year. And she's already made her announcements to me that she's going to become a doctor. And I told her to hurry up. But I figured on retiring when she gets out of medical school. But I almost lost that child. I almost lost her sober at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I lost her through my own fear. Through my own fear and my own doubt, right here. Because she acted like me. And I was afraid she had this illness of mine. And so I was going to make sure she didn't. And so every time she acted like me, I scolded her. And I'm like, I don't know how you are, but I'll tell you how I am. Because I'm so frightened and inadequate most of the time, I do things in the name of love that are pure egotism. I browbeat people where people can hear me. It makes me a big man. So I think. And I used to do that to my daughter in front of her sister, her mother, her grandmother, or anybody who would listen. I would humiliate her and browbeat her because I figured that was humility. Humility and humiliation are entirely different things. But I didn't know that. And I'm sober, and I'm running around telling everybody how wonderful I am, and I'll call it nonsense. And one day I'm driving down the street, and I said to myself, I owe that child an apology. I went home, and I sat down at the table that night in the quietness of the room with her sister and her mother and I, and I looked across the table at her, and I said to her, Karen, I'm sorry. I've been trying to create something out of you because of my own fear, because I'm so frightened that you may not want to be. And I want to tell you that from this day on, all I'm going to do is love you. And wherever you go and whatever you do, I'm going to give you the freedom to know that. But remember, I always love you. And you can always rely on that. And I broke that wall down, and there's a communication between that child and me, the like of which you never seen. A little while after that, she went down to get the highest award that a Catholic Girl Scout can get, called the Marian Medal. And it's bestowed on them by the bishop. And on a Sunday morning, we went down to the Mother Church in Los Angeles. Now, I can say this because I don't have any organized religion, so I'm not affiliated in anything. But I sat in that church, and this little girl went down there, and it was a hot day. We went out in the courtyard, my father-in-law and I, and we stepped out into the courtyard, and there was a fence there. And on one side of the fence was the Midnight Mission. It's a parking lot, and they were sleeping in doorways and up against the walls and so on and so forth. And I broke down and I started crying. And my father-in-law put his arms around me. He said, what's the matter, Johnny? And I said, Pop, the only difference between them guys and me is a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went back in and we sit down in this church, this big, old, beautiful church. And I watched this little girl of mine who I'd almost run out of my house in a white dress come out of that aisle, and I'm leaning out the aisle, and she walked up and started to kneel before the bishop to get this medal. And right before she got that medal, she turned around and winked at me. And I came apart of the tears. And I don't cry very quietly. But I almost missed that, you see. I almost missed that on account of I was so scared here. That I could talk to you about fear, but I knew nothing about fear. And now, when I tell somebody I love them, I mean it. I love them enough to take them off in the corner and tell them when I think they're out of line. I do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to browbeat them from podium. I used to tear about this and that and the other from podium, but I found that's not my thing. Or if I couldn't do that, I'd get in a crowd and do it in my home group. Because I'm a big man in my home group. If you don't believe it, come over there Monday night, watch me mop the floors. And if you don't believe that, come 6:30, I'll let you help me make chairs, set the chairs up. I get to do all the odd jobs nobody else wants to do. And sometimes I'm standing around the big man who founded the group, and I'm cursing because I'm mopping that floor. And I curse until I look right alongside of me, and I see a little guy who's sober 60 days. And he's mopping the floor. And another guy on this side of me who's 5 or 6 years sober, and he's mopping the floor, and they both call me the sponsor. And the thing that they're impressed about is not that I was in New Hampshire on a Sunday morning talking to you people, but I still think enough of my own sobriety to get in and mop that floor on Monday night. That impresses the people. So if you really want to know what kind of people who are addressing you from podiums in Alcoholics Anonymous, go visit them at their home groups. Fantastic thing to see what they do there. My home group is the Big Book Group in Bellflower, and you're all invited down there on Monday night. Come anytime you want to. Because I'll be there. My plane gets in at 8:17 tomorrow, and my meeting starts at 8:30. I won't get to set up the chairs, and I'm very sad about that. But I guess what I would really like to tell you this morning, I'd like to tell you that I love you very much. I'd like to stand here this morning and thank you for every living thing that I have. I'd like to thank you for the way I feel inside. I'd like to thank if my children feel half as good inside looking at me as I feel looking at you. I'm going to be a success in life with my children. That's the way I feel about it. I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned about the love of my child, the one that I told she could do anything she wanted to do. I just want to love her. I learned that by the example of your love towards me. Because I've come in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in all various stages. Broke, money in my pocket, scared, frightened, unpraying, o-praying, all kinds of things. And nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous has ever told me, get out of here, we don't love you. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous has ever told me, you don't act a certain way, so we're not going to love you. All they ever told me is that you just keep coming in here and let us love you till you can learn to love yourself. You just keep coming in here and let us pray for you till you can learn to pray for yourself. You let us keep understanding you until you can understand yourself. Then you, in turn, can turn around and start doing some of these things back again. Since I first came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never, ever wanted to do anything else. Since my first time that I ever stuck my nose into the program of recovery in our book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never wanted to do anything else. And through the working applications of the principles of the program called Alcoholics Anonymous, today I stand before you with a God of my very own. I stand before you with so much love that I could share it to the world and never even care about it. I feel like I'm an ocean. I got so much that if I give away a ton, I'd never lose anything. But I'm just a channel for my Father and you. And we're all his children. So I'd like to thank you for that. And the way I can best tell you about it is that my little girl, my little 12-year-old girl, one time I got up on a Sunday morning and I started to go to a meeting, and she come running out. She said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, Daddy, it's my birthday. And God, I had this commitment, and I said, geez, I'm sorry, Jackie. I felt guilty, and I took my coat, and she ran away from me and started to cry. And I snuck out the door, and about the time I started to get in my car, she showed up at the doorway. She said, just a minute, Dad. And I went and said, okay, sweetheart. And she came out and she threw her arms around my neck and she tugged me and she kissed me. Looked at me with those big brown eyes and she said to me, when you get to that meeting, will you do something for me, Daddy? And I said, if I can. She said, will you thank the people of Alcoholics Anonymous for my daddy? See, if it hadn't been for you taking time out of your life to come to me, I wouldn't be here. And that little girl wouldn't be here. And if she was here, I wouldn't be here to take care of her. So I thank you for that. Matter of fact, I could stand here all morning and thank you for everything that I have. But I tell you what I really like to do. Other than the fact to tell you that I love you and I appreciate the weekend to meet and love all you people. I'd like to stand here today and thank my God for Alcoholics Anonymous. But more important, I think, I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my God. Thank you.
would like to call on the chaplain, a good personal friend and a great friend of AA, for the invocation, the chaplain of the U.S. House of Representatives, Dr. Ford.
Ed, before I give the invocation, I want to say that, as I said to Ed when I came in, with a crowd like this, every preacher wants to take a collection. We never let it get by. May I also say just briefly how pleased I am to be invited. The A's and A's group here had their first meeting in the Capitol 2 years ago, in my office. And we found a better place than that. But Ed was in on that, Craig, who's here. And I've been a supporter, and I mean an enthusiastic supporter, of the work of AA all these years. And let me take this personal time to thank Ed, too, who is a phone call away in my work. When I want help and assistance, that phone is there, and Ed is in my office, and we've got help. And I appreciate what he does and what AA does. So I'm pleased and honored to be invited to be here today. Let us pray. We thank you, O God, for this day, and for the opportunities and responsibilities that are ours. We are especially grateful for your many gifts to us, the gifts of understanding and tolerance, knowledge and reconciliation, the gift of family, friends, and colleagues, the gifts of faith and hope and love, the gift of life itself. We are thankful that we can gather this day in freedom. May your blessing be upon our nation and its leaders, and may we continue to know the liberties that have been our heritage. Your word has commanded that justice should roll down as waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. May we labor for justice that people can live in respect and dignity. And may we use our talents and abilities for righteousness so all people may live in peace. Now bless this food to our use, and us to your faithful service, we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Doctor. I will announce the lunches, sir. We will start the program promptly at 12:45. Enjoy your lunch. 1986 Congressional Luncheon. My name is Ed Chandler, and I'm an alcoholic. I wonder if there are any other alcoholics in the room. Any Al-Anons? Maybe you all heard this. I didn't until a couple of days ago. When an Al-Anon dies, her husband's life passes in front of her eyes. We also welcome Alateens, Alatots, Alapets, whatever. This is the 5th Congressional Luncheon, and the crowd gets a little bigger each time, and the sponsored mostly by the Yeas and Nays groups that meets in the U.S. Capitol at 8 o'clock every Tuesday morning. And there are occasionally some empty chairs. If you would care to get up early enough to come down, I'd be delighted to have you. The luncheon has developed to some people who are not members of AA, but who have some interest in alcoholism, or more specifically recovery from alcoholism, come and join us. And some today have brought employees, some have brought their boss, and we're delighted to have the non-members of AA come to this forum. Primarily, it's to have a great AA meeting, but we're delighted to have other people from the non-AA community come and be with us. I'd like to recognize a couple in the audience at this time. The Federal Aviation Administration has, I guess, one of the finest alcoholism programs ever anywhere, and due in large part to a man who's with us today, the chief psychiatrist at FAA, Dr. Bart Packel. Dr. Packel.
Hey, Bart.
And Fulton Caldwell, NIAAA, is here. Fulton? The regional trustee to General Service Office in New York, Garrett Taylor. Garrett, where are you? And any time there's a group gathered on Capitol Hill of any sort, if he's present, it's more than appropriate that it be introduced. A longtime congressman from the state of Arkansas, former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, the Honorable Wilbur Mills. I could probably introduce him another way if I wanted to. Also delighted to have from the Duggar from the Virgin Islands, the Honorable Ron DeLugo. Ron, good to have you here. tapes of the speaker will be available at this table on my left as soon as the meeting is over. It is appropriate that any time a group comes to Capitol Hill to be formally and officially welcomed by a member of Congress, and we've made provisions to have you so done today. And to make some welcoming opening remarks, I'd like to call on the congressman from the 8th Congressional District, the state of Washington, the Honorable Rod Chandler.
Thank you very much, Cousin Ed. I can't begin to tell you what an honor and a privilege it is to have this opportunity to greet all of you to this luncheon for the second year in a row. I have had such a warm place in my heart for all of you since I came here in 1983 and made that telephone call to Dr. Ford and had him say, yes, there's a fellow named Ed Chandler, and he will see to it that you get to some meetings. And boy, did I ever. And I'm afraid to miss now. And the warmth and the feeling of love and friendship and to get to know Wilbur and Ron and all the rest of you has just been a delightful experience in my life. Speaking of life, let me also, with that reminder, introduce to you the Al-Anon in the family, my wife Joyce. I want to be serious, of course, but I think we also have to provide a little bit of levity, and maybe I can accomplish both in the same way. Dr. Ford and I think all of us in the fellowship certainly are sensitive to that third step premise of God's will. And I have a story about...
What an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after made clear three pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That God could and would if he were sought.
The speaker part of the program, which is outstanding today. I'll call on, to introduce the speaker, I'll call on Hal M.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Hal Marley. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And for those of you who don't know me, I try to live an attitude of gratitude because I got so much to be grateful for. Today, my gratitude cup runneth over. Those of you who have been around long, you know that these conferences or luncheons like this don't just happen. It takes that horrible, dirty, four-letter word, W-O-R-K, a word that I have assiduously avoided for 71 years. However it takes it, and I would like to thank Ed and the committee here that have done an outstanding job, and it was work to make this possible. Ed, thank you. I'm grateful to all of you for showing up and making the biggest and best. Every year it gets bigger and better, just like AA all over the world. Better all the time. And on top of it all, we have this charming young lady from all the way from L.A. I met June in 1975. She was a Saturday night speaker at Palm Desert, right next to Palm Springs. At that time, as I remember, she was 16 years old. Had 3 years sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she just completed her GED, her high school equivalency, and she was pleased. She'd been working hard in this program. This program is beginning to pay off. Well, that's been 11 years ago, and I'm not going to say what's happened in between. I wouldn't dare presume to deny you the privilege of hearing from June in her own words her experiences, strengths, and hopes over these last 11 years. I will ask you this, if there is any person in this room who does not believe in miracles, who has never seen one, please take a good look at June. She is indeed a walking, living, viable example of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracle of AA. Please help me in welcoming June. June?
Thank you. My name is June. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I really want to thank all of you for inviting me here and letting me be a part of this with all of you, and for giving me a chance to see Ed and Hal again. They're two real special people in my heart. I kept thinking this morning, I've had such a fabulous trip so far, and I see this is going to be a long talk. I just thought there's really no way you can get from where I come from to where I am today. It takes a lot more than a plane ticket to get from where I came from in Venice, California, to where I am today. And I don't know exactly how it's all happened, really. It's been a lot of meetings and a lot of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope in my life. I thought it's so incredible. When I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the time I got here, my own family would not allow me in the home or to call under any circumstances. I'd been thrown out of a number of different places at that point. I really had no place left to go. And I came down here last night, and Ed invited me out, and I went out with a lot of different people that I got a chance to meet, I guess maybe about 10 of them. And every one of them has offered to share part of the next couple of days with me. And Herb arranged a tour for us this morning of the Supreme Court. And Ed took me over there, and Hal took me last night and showed me just how beautiful your city is. And I kept thinking about that this morning, too. I thought, isn't it amazing? I mean, you guys, many of you had never even met me before. And I tell you that 13 and a half years ago, my own family didn't even want me. And here you all are, and you're inviting me to do things and share part of your life. And God, I can't be anything but grateful. I want anyone to know who might be visiting or new to Alcoholics Anonymous that I am not an expert on alcoholism or on Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not an authority. I'm not paid to get up here and share. I know when you're done, you're going to think, thank God they didn't have to pay her for that. But I'm just another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came here to share a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't help but be tremendously impressed with what is accomplished in my life. And I think the thing that impresses me the most, and even more so the longer I stay sober, is not only what it has accomplished with my life, but that it has given me a life that I never would have wanted any part of. And what's interesting about that is that the life that I've been given that I never would have wanted any part of is the best life I've ever had. And it's sort of an interesting paradox, one of the many that happen in our lives here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had an obsession before alcohol, and that obsession was with suicide. And it began at the age of 5 years old. And from the time that I was 5 years old until the time that I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't one day in my life that I didn't do something to take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please take my life. That really was my number one goal. It was what I wanted the most, and obviously I wasn't very successful at it, but I want you to know I gave it a good try. Fortunately for someone like me, I was introduced to drugs at the age of 7 years old. I began to use alcohol on a regular basis about a year later, and by the time I was 9, I was finding the combination that was to work for me until I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was barbiturates or downers or reds or yellows, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. I very rarely altered that combination at all because the combined effect of those chemicals got me exactly where I wanted to go, and that was complete oblivion. I was never a party girl. I was never a social drinker.